The Cyber Show is pre-recorded from our studios in Pebble Beach, California. This show is sponsored by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Hi, I'm Fred.
I'm Brett.
And I'm Chris.
And this is The Cyber Show.
Would you like to have some cyber fun? Join the show and the fun will come.
This week on The Cyber Show, another pitcher tries to hit a home run. Peter talks ethics, or the lack thereof. More fraud, spies, and lies. Simpson eats hot chili peppers to be macho. Doug gets into group sects. And who knows what else? Here we go. This week on The Cyber Show, another pitcher tries to hit a home run. Peter talks ethics, or the lack thereof. More fraud, spies, and lies. Simpson eats hot chili peppers to be macho. Doug gets into group sects. And who knows what else? Here we go.
No politics, no religion, none of the seven dirty words. Don't believe what anyone on the show tells you. Check it out for yourself. The views expressed do not reflect those of the management or owners of the station, the websites involved, the sponsors, or anyone other than the individuals expressing them, and in many cases, not even them.
Everyone, we have an announcement to make.
Fred here. On April 11th, the All.net Members Forum. You can meet with cybersecurity experts from around the world, and discuss all sorts of interesting things. For more details, go to thecybershow.co.
For details on anything you hear about at The Cyber Show, go to thecybershow.co.
This segment's called The Pitch. In The Pitch, a company presents in the hopes that you, the listening audience, will find them interesting enough to go the next step.
Hi, everybody, and a very pleasant Wednesday to you, wherever you may be.
Sandy into his windup. Here's The Pitch.
We have Rick here from Garage Skins. In the simplest terms you can, tell our listeners, what does Garage Skins do?
We manufacture and sell directly to the consumer a set of panels that actually snap directly onto your steel overhead garage door that transform it from just a boring normal door into the look of a true high-quality real wood.
All right, in simple terms, you make magnetic snap-on panels that snap on top of a metal garage door.
Yep.
In 5 or 10 minutes, I can turn my old metal garage door into something that looks like a barn or, you know, whatever, right?
Yep, that's exactly what we do.
The cost of getting a new garage door.
Well, if you did real wood, probably $10,000 to $15,000 for a two-car garage door. If you did something like, one of these vinyl overlay doors, you're still looking at $7,000 to $8,000. And what they're not telling you is it's 7 to 8 months to get it.
Right. That's a supply chain issue, which is
absolutely
crazy right now. Yeah. All right. Yep. So it'll take forever. It'll be very expensive. And you'll probably have to replace the whole thing, right? Because you have to have different motors because it weighs different amounts. You have to get the
absolutely
new garage door openers. You'll have to integrate it with your car again, which I've not been able to do with my garage door yet. And probably have to get it on the internet, right? But because they probably won't work without being on the internet anymore. But with your solution, I order these panels. Are they custom panels?
They're not. You know, it's pretty standard in the industry anymore as to what sizes there are. So we've only got 12 different sizes, and that pretty much covers everything out there.
There you go. So I just pick the design I want. If I want, can I get a custom design? Can I, like, get my family picture on the garage door?
Not yet, but that's coming way down the road. We've got to walk before we run and then sprint.
All right. So now what does it cost if I call up Rick and say, hey, Rick, here's my garage, and you know, I tell him the make and the model, and what does it cost, and how long does it take for me to get that? And you just ship it to me and I stick it up there, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's just a couple boxes that show up UPS directly to your front door. If you call me today, $22.95 covers a two-car garage door. We're going to
wait a minute. $22.95?
That's exactly right. Or we move the decimal and say $2,295.
All right. So thank you. You know, people say $19.95, yeah, right. I'll repaint your house. Yeah,
we're not going to be around very long, but, you know, it's a good deal.
All right. So about $2,200, right?
Yep.
And by the way, because it's such a savings and so easy and it's so convenient, how long does it take if I order one today to get one?
Well, we're pretty backlogged right now, but, you know, we're out raising capital to put more machinery, more people to work. So optimally, probably about 6 to 8 weeks.
6 to 8 weeks, which is way less time than it would take to get an actual garage door,
yeah,
you know, ordered and so forth. But they probably wouldn't even come out to measure it before then. All right. I take out my credit card. I put it into your website. 6 to 8 weeks later, I get the thing. I stick it up on my garage door. Deal done. It's going to stay through any weather.
Yep.
It's probably better for weather than my existing garage door, right?
Well, it is. If you got steel, of course, that's one thing. But, you know, we've solved all the problems of putting wood on the outside of the garage door because these things are real wood. We actually use real wood veneers. And then we stick it over a very light foam core, put the magnets in it so that it, you don't have to change out your garage door opener. You don't have to change out your springs or anything. But if you can think about it, sticking wood out on a garage door, you know, your sprinklers are hitting it, ice, snow, hail, all that kind of stuff. We've been through years and years of lab testing to make sure we got it right.
You have like a 10-year guarantee?
We do not. We've got a 1-year guarantee right now. The more we get them out there and get some longevity, we'll probably extend that to 2 years. But we've got a system that's been up in Houston for about 4 years. It's survived 2 hurricanes, still looks just like it did when we put it up.
There you go. And look, frankly, wood is just nicer because of the way I am as somebody that wants to invest in businesses and such. So you are taking investment. If they go to thecybershow.co, we have the link to your website and they can go there, but they can also look at your GWiz. And your GWiz for investors will go through the details and they'll have to assert, yes, I'm an accredited investor or otherwise authorized. And then they can see the details of the investment and all that stuff. Let me just ask you, you know, how big is this going to be? How many garage doors are there in the world?
Well, in the world, we don't know yet. We did a market study for the United States. There's 97 million existing garage doors out there right now. 35 million of them are actually compatible with our systems. And we have patents backing this. So it's our space for the time being.
You know, 35 million times 2,000 is 70 yep. billion.
70 billion. We figured our total addressable market about 80 billion.
From every 10 years, it's only $7 billion a year. So that's not exactly.
Darn it. Yeah. Well, you know, we'll try hard.
$7 billion a year. So
we'll try hard.
All right. Not a big business, but it's sustainable, right?
We can pay the rent.
So go to thecybershow.co and look this stuff up. And Rick, it's great to talk to you. And we look forward to talking to you more in the future and potentially making an investment after we spend the time to do diligence.
Thanks, Fred. Appreciate it.
There's a drive into deep left field. Look out now. That ball is going. Going out. And they're resting. Hits it over the left field fence for a home run. And the Pirates win it 10-9 and win the World Series.
For more details on this pitch and to view their GWiz, go to thecybershow.co and click on their listing.
That was absolutely amazing.
Breaking news on the Cyber Show. More than 100 of the richest tech leaders on the planet have expressed their fear of the new AI chatbots. While none of them state that the technology is anywhere near actual intelligence, all of them want everyone else to stop making advances while they think about it. Of course, none of them stop their development of these and other technologies to think about them.
And now a word from our sponsor.
Fred here. On April 11th, the All.net Members Forum. You can meet with cybersecurity experts from around the world and discuss all sorts of interesting things. For more details, go to thecybershow.co. To get in touch with companies presenting on the show, you can go to thecybershow.co and look them up. During this segment of the show, we talk to historical figures from the cyber world. We're discussing the history of the cyber world with Peter Neumann. His long career exemplifies a great deal of the time and effort and expertise involved in the development of the cyber world that we live in today.
They don't teach total system trustworthiness. They don't teach ethics. They don't teach in the risk forum. I just had a big hoodoo about ethics 2 issues ago.
You're not putting the articles anymore. You're putting in pointers to a lot of places. So it's, you know, a lot less convenient to read it as reading. But
well, I'm being meticulous about not putting in entire articles that are behind paywalls.
Because of the copyright issue. Because you're trying to be ethical and legal.
That's right.
It's fair use. I think there's a fair use issue here. But
well, I strip it down. I strip it down or write a summary of it or I excerpt it severely. But I believe that I need the support. I've been a reader of the New York Times pretty much every day since 1938.
I support authorship and ownership.
Yeah,
absolutely. But there's a different issue here because of the complexity of the whole, you know, for somebody who's trying to keep up to date, when you write a textbook on it and you quote the relevant parts of the article and you summarize it properly and you put it in the context, then you have a meaningful educational component that codifies what was in the article.
Yeah.
But you're not doing that level of authorship on the risks form, or else you wouldn't be able to do anything else. And you probably wouldn't be able to do that.
Well, right? I do spend a lot of time boiling down an article that I read in the Times and put in a summary of it, or I put in the URL for the paper.
All right. Fair enough. The educational problem is solved by people like you doing this.
Yes, that's true.
But there's another set of educational problems at the university level.
Mm-hmm.
And you may recall some years ago, I was at one of these meetings at SRI, and we had a bunch of researchers publishing papers on how they did whatever with spam emails by in the middle of the infrastructure interfering and modifying content on route and so forth.
Right.
And I raised my hand and mentioned, you know, excuse me, this is illegal. You know, I don't know if you've heard of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, but you're not allowed to do this. And then there's this. And that, I think, is a side effect produced, hopefully along with others, a change in the way they started to think about that. And they improved that process of trying to make sure that the researchers were doing things ethically as well. And obviously not the first time that happened. Can you talk to us at all about the ethics of that research community in cybersecurity, especially when we talk about, you know, red team, blue team, and people that break into systems for fees? They're making money by figuring out how to break in and not, you know, selling the vulnerabilities.
Well, I think it was two issues ago. You go to risks.org and you'll find the entire history of every risk issue that's ever been put out. We had an article on what's happening in the future, what seems to be happening. And I pointed out that back in the 80s, the guys, one person at Yale and Deborah Johnson, Bynum at Yale and Deborah Johnson at RPI, had written extensively on computer ethics. Deborah has two books out. And Bynum has a whole bunch of reports that they did under NSF funding. And all of that, in some amorphous sense, has worked its way into the ACM and IEEE standards. This is supposed to be in the curricula of everything. Now, Spafford, who was also in both of those meetings with Bynum and Deborah Johnson, pointed out that he teaches a course at Purdue on computer ethics. Most other universities pay obeisance to it.
On all.net, you know, we follow the IEEE code of ethics, and there it is.
No, the point is that nobody is teaching it, and almost nobody is teaching it. If they are, they're giving it maybe one lecture at the end of a course. And most companies are not even paying any attention to it.
Brett, computer ethics, you teach in the university. What do you think about Peter's view on this?
I think what you'll find at universities and colleges is that they're really constrained as to how many courses they can require their students to take. And they already have to cut a lot of things out of the curricula, computer science curricula, or software engineering program curricula that we would like to have in there, but we can't devote a whole course often to a topic like ethics as it applies to computing. So what we do is we weave examples and principles of ethical computing into courses on algorithms and so on. So it's not that it's not covered, and it's not that we don't feel that, I'm speaking maybe for my profession, but maybe I shouldn't speak for everybody. But for myself, I feel like we do justice to the topic of ethics. We just can't devote an entire semester or quarter course on that topic.
So I'm going to put this in a different context. It seems to me that universities have a responsibility. Forget about the computer science curriculum or the whatever curriculum. Universities have a responsibility to society to include ethics in their criteria for anybody getting a bachelor's or an associate's degree that says ethics are a critical part of life in society. If you have to take a course in English to graduate, whatever it is, if you're in arts, you know, whether you're doing painting or music or engineering or science or writing or Spanish or whatever, ethics and social responsibility are a fundamental part of your overarching education. And I think there's been a diffusion of sort of underlying fundamental curriculum across universities writ large, with, we'll call it the customization of programs towards particular verticals.
Yeah.
And part of it is there's so much stuff to know now. There's an enormous, vast body of knowledge. The other thing is, you know, look at trade education, trade training, they'll call it, but look at high school and grade school. We should be teaching ethics at every level of education and training. Mm-hmm. And the specific ethical issues associated with a particular course, I think, should be directed towards that course. I mean, if I'm teaching compiler design or something like that, which is a, you know, a very technical thing, if I'm teaching how to build electrical motors, what are the ethical issues in building electrical motors? Right? I shouldn't be focusing on general situation ethics if I'm talking about building electrical motors. On the other hand, if you're becoming a researcher in a field, if you're at a master's level or a PhD level, and you're becoming a researcher in, you know, attacking computer systems or defending computer systems, there's a whole bunch of ethics issues associated with working in the workplace that are just not addressed at all. And, you know, I've done consulting for many years in the workplace, and I face serious ethical challenges each time. I go in because they're having a problem. Somebody has done something wrong. Somebody's violated a law. They don't know what's happened. I'm in an investigation. I'm testifying in court. Whatever that is that's going on, if you're in cybersecurity, something's going on that's bad.
Yeah. Right?
Maybe illegal, almost certainly unethical. It is your job in cybersecurity to deal with those ethical issues. You're going to be bribed. You're going to be extorted. People are going to lie to you when you do an assessment or review, you know, all of these functions you do. And by the way, how about policing? You know, if you're in the police force, how do you treat prisoners, right? I mean, it's part of the court. So if you're in cybersecurity, if you're in anything security, clearly there's got to be a heavy ethical, a heavy safety function, a heavy follow the law while you enforce the law function.
But once again, you're assuming, or you're making kind of a statement that implies that we have one set of mores and norms and one set of laws, but we have a global supply chain, whether, you know, for cyber. It's, we have, you know, Microsoft hires developers from around the world. Companies source components, hardware, software from all over to create a system. And so we don't have like this unified idea of what is ethical and not ethical. I mean, there are certain things that I think most people would agree around the world are not ethical, like taking bribes, but in some cultures, bribery is just part of the way of operating, and they don't see.
But I think my point is that's what we have to teach.
Yeah.
Right. So if bribery is part of the deal, you got to know that bribery is part of the deal.
Right. But if you're a U.S.
citizen, that it's illegal here and required there. That's the point, right? I'm not saying my standard of behavior. Mm-hmm. I'm saying if you're going to operate in a field of endeavor, you need to know how it works.
Yeah, you need to actually practice ethical behavior by if the supplier is in a country that is requiring a bribe and it's okay in that country, maybe you shouldn't be sourcing your certain software widgets from that country and from that particular supplier that practices bribery. I mean, yeah. So,
or maybe the only supply source for those chips is China.
Yeah.
And you have to pay off an official to get it across the border during a pandemic.
But is that ethical? And is it legal? It's not legal.
It is the nature of ethics that there are trade-offs.
Right.
So if it's illegal, it's illegal. But on the other hand,
yeah,
how are you going to exist as a country? Right. Suppose you're doing it in the United States and you're doing it as part of national security and you need to get these chips from China and it requires a bribe. Okay. Well, so it turns out that, you know, if I have to bribe somebody in China to do something, there's probably a mechanism to do it legally if I'm working for the United States government, if right. I'm working in the intelligence community. Yeah. But how do I know that? How do I learn how to deal with that situation? I go into companies as a consultant, right? Where people are lying. I get in legal cases where I'm there to authenticate or not authenticate evidence, and I find, you know, that the evidence is fabricated. I don't say it's fabricated. I say it's inconsistent with the asserted provenance of that evidence as identified in the testimony of the party that stated that, right? That's inconsistent, that the records indicate this and the statement indicated that, and that that's inconsistent. But that's my responsibility. That's my job. And I have to do it legally and I have to do it ethically. And if I don't know what that means, I can't. So if I'm educating somebody in cybersecurity about defending a network with a firewall, I have to understand the laws associated with surveillance and whether I'm allowed to look at the traffic on the firewall or what I'm allowed to look at under what circumstance. That's what I mean by education in ethics. I need to know the rules. I need to know what to do in those circumstances because my job is not just technology. My job is a socially interacting human being within an environment in cybersecurity, which is not the same as computer programmer.
But like you said, I mean, ethics is not just about rules. Ethics is about having some moral compass and understanding of, you know, what's right from wrong and how to make decisions in those gray areas.
Yes, it is. And there are a lot of gray areas. And again, that's why we need education. I can't just say here's the rule book.
Well, there is no rule book. There's no cookbook. And yeah,
there are codes of ethics. I follow the IEEE code of ethics. One of the things in the IEEE code of ethics says that if you're a professional in a particular area, cybersecurity, and you see misinformation spread to the public, you have a responsibility to correct it.
Okay.
I'm on LinkedIn. I see publications by so-called computer security experts. I have a responsibility to respond by saying, no, that's not right. But you know what? In that social environment, that creates problems. Problems for me as an individual, problems for you as an individual. If you're not doing that response, if you're not standing up for the truth, for what you know to be true, for your beliefs, what have you, you're not being ethical in your field.
Right.
Now, that doesn't mean, you know, taking a political position. That means when somebody makes a statement, which was made on LinkedIn in the last day or so, that says companies are losing billions of dollars per incident, blah, 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 and have been over the last several years, that I have a responsibility to post once I see it and know about it. I never read it. I don't have the responsibility. But if I see it and know about it, I have a responsibility to say that's not right. Or at least to say, can you provide specific evidence for what you're claiming? Because as far as I'm aware, that's not an accurate representation. When I do that, I get some negative affect associated with it from some people, and some people, you know, might decide to be nasty to me. I can decide not to live in that environment, or I have to hold up to my responsibilities. So the question of what is responsible social behavior, what is ethical behavior, how do those standards of ethics apply to you in those situations in the modern world with social media? Do you educate students in that? Do you tell them that? And do they, you know, do you enforce that in your educational program? Or is that something you just don't even address?
Right. Yeah, I'm not sure how what you would put into a standalone course. I guess I should take a look at what Gene Spafford has at Purdue and other.
I suspect you will not find that Gene is doing these responses either. He's not standing up for the IEEE code of ethics and what it says, because my interpretation of it is different than his.
Right. But that's the thing. These are standards of conduct. They're not hard and fast rules. And it's a matter of, you know, character and other human qualities that as to how people actually carry out their duty of being ethical.
Yeah, it's a conversation we need to have in our community all the time.
Right. I agree.
Brought to you by Angel to Exit. We help grow companies.
And now a word from our sponsor.
Fred here. On April 11th, the All.net Members Forum. You can meet with cybersecurity experts from around the world and discuss all sorts of interesting things. For more details, go to thecybershow.co. Frauds, Spies, and Lies and How to Defeat Them. It's the name of a book, and now it's the name of a segment on our show.
There's a wonderful paper that was written called 442 Startup Failure Postmortems. When I say wonderful, it was about failures of startups, but I thought it was very interesting because it pointed out a lot of things. And one of the things it points out is a lot of these negative outcomes have come from frauds of various sorts or possible future frauds and other things that people describe in different ways. So I thought I would go through several of these and give examples of some of the fraudulent businesses or the worries about prosecution of CEOs in charge of different companies. Here we go. This one's from a company called CoinPrism. It's a press release about their web wallet. And in an email, their founder and CEO wrote,
"We didn't see a business model that would have been viable long term. Regulators are starting to pay attention to the cryptocurrency space, and activities around blockchain assets are likely to become heavily regulated in the next 5 years. That means some of these services will have to shut down or restrict their activities. Some might go to prison. And only a small number of well-capitalized companies will successfully adapt to the regulators' demands."
A brief comment on this. We didn't see a business model that would have been viable long term. This is crazy. These companies get, in many cases, I don't know about this case, tens or even hundreds of millions of dollars, and they don't have a business model that would be viable. Who's doing the evaluation of these companies? Who's doing due diligence before making those investments if there's no viable long-term business model? Even a short-term business model that succeeds to the point where you can exit would be useful. But apparently, they didn't bother to think through that before they started the process. Here's a company called Baru. It's a pet care startup, and so the CEO, nobody at the company said this, but this was a description of what was asserted about it.
"Despite Baru's efforts to focus on providing dog walking and pet sitting services to high-end rental buildings, the startup faced steep competition from well-funded companies that serve more cities. Wag, for instance, was founded the same year as Baru, but it has expanded to more than 100 cities after raising exorbitant amounts of venture capital. A few weeks before Baru shuttered, the Los Angeles-based company raised a $300 million round from Japanese tech giant SoftBank."
This falls in the JDLR, just don't look right category. So they raise a few hundred million dollars from a bank in Japan and then shutter in a few weeks. What happened to the few $300 million? Pretty suspicious sounding to me. Now, this one's from a company called Jawbone. And, when you hear about it, you're going to say, oh, wait a minute.
Jawbone co-founder and CEO has founded a new company called Jawbone Health Hub that will make health-related hardware and software services. Many employees of Jawbone moved to the new firm earlier this year. Jawbone Health will service Jawbone's devices going forward. A notice sent to creditors said Jawbone entered into insolvency proceedings under California law on June 19. A company has been set up to liquidate Jawbone's assets. Jawbone hired Sherwood Partners to handle the matter. The notice says creditors have 180 days to file a claim.
Okay, so the CEO and co-founder starts another company that has the same name, well, a slightly different name, that's going to service the thing that his previous company, which is now failing, failed to succeed at. Uh-oh. A bunch of employees moved earlier in the year before they sent a notice to creditors saying they were going to enter into insolvency proceedings. All of this according to what was cited as insights from a source close to the company. So I suspect we're looking at lawsuits here. And frankly, when you leave one company to form another of almost the same name that uses the things the previous company developed that the investors spent money on, and you're now going to make the first one go out of business so that the investors get basically screwed out of whatever they have and your new company can start from scratch, that sounds problematic to me. And maybe it's legal, but it sure as heck doesn't sound ethical, at least at first shot. Now, of course, this isn't just a phenomenon in the U.S. Here's Wikimart. Oh, my goodness. So this is a wikimart.ru. So it's a Russian company that went bankrupt after raising dozens of millions. The East West Digital News reported on how international sanctions, mismanagement, and strategic missteps contributed to the failure of this Russian e-commerce platform that had raised $81 million
in disclosed funding. 6 months prior to their demise in 2017, the co-founder wrote the following note on the company's Facebook page.
After almost a two-year break, I have spent 2 days at the company. Majority shareholders abandoned it. The company does not have assets to save and competencies to preserve. 20 months of my absence have allowed the professional top managers to kill the company using the money of rich oligarchs. They have spent twice more than we spent since the company's inception in 2008 till August 2014. And everything has been lost or stolen, mostly lost.
Now here's an interesting one from Australia. This is a case where a company shut down after it took $185 million from investors when they couldn't go public because the Security and Investment Commission in Australia said no. All right, so let's see what happened there.
Australian music streaming company Guvera has reportedly stopped operating, with its co-founder and biggest financial backer walking away from the project. The startup, which was established in 2008, privately raised $185 million. Before its $100 million initial public offering was blocked by the Australian Securities Exchange last year, Guvera's IPO prospectus was widely criticized and the company was forced to issue an updated version with 45 amendments after scrutiny from the Australian Securities and Investments Commission. The company had lost $81 million in the 2016 financial year with revenue of just $1.2 million.
I don't know, somehow, if you lose $81 million and generate $1.2 million in revenue, something is wrong in your equations. I suspect that there was a calculation error somewhere in this one. Now, this was just a little bit more mysterious. Apparently, VidAngel crowdfunded $10 million, and the court ordered them to shut the business down. There's no description of why this order took place, but here's what the release says.
The judge has issued a preliminary injunction against VidAngel, requiring that we pull down all the studio's content. We are seeking a stay of this injunction, but if our efforts fail, we will need to take down the movies of all major studios.
Now, I could be wrong, but it sounds to me like what they were doing was putting up videos from major studios without their permission or without paying royalties or some such thing. But again, I don't know any of the facts in this particular case. So we're at the end of our quick summary. Now, this was just a few of the hundreds of companies that are described in this wonderful article, and we hope to pull out a few of them here and there. They include some of the big ones you've heard of and a lot of the smaller ones you probably haven't heard of. But I have to say that when you start to look at the reasons companies fail, boy, it's informative. Every week we'll feature another cyber fraud to help keep you aware of what's going on and what you can do about it. If you'd like to read the book, Fraud, Spies, and Lies and How to Defeat Them, it's available online at all.net under books. That's ALL.NET, and you press on books.
This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
We're talking with Simpson here, who has a long career, both as a cybersecurity, we'll call it threat actor for the moment, and as a journalist. Okay, welcome back, Simpson. So
yeah,
you graduated from college, and at some point,
well,
because you got into your actual career.
Jumping ahead, like, you wanted everything, right? So like the summer between my third and fourth year at MIT, I go to Israel for the summer and work at the Weizmann Institute doing computer instrumentation. And I actually get to meet Adi Shamir while he's there, and there's all this stuff going on. And it was very frustrating because they wouldn't give me administrator access on the computer, right? And I wanted it.
So naturally.
So it turns out that at the time they were gauging whether or not you were you would get the access is if you were macho enough, right? Because this is Israel. And so one day I was at the shuk, the market, and I bought a bag of these dried chili peppers, right? And I brought them back to my office and I started just chewing on them. And people were like aghast that I would just like spend the day chewing on the chili peppers. And they thought I was really macho, and they gave me root. System admin privileges on the computer.
So you social engineered them by eating.
I was cool enough.
I love it.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
All right. So moving right along.
Yeah. So I ended up graduating MIT, and I didn't know what I wanted to do, but I'd been writing for the MIT newspaper. So I applied to some journalism schools, and I got into a few of them and went to Columbia. And then I graduated Columbia in I was at Columbia from 87 to 88. And in the fall of 87, the stock market crashed, right? And 88 was the beginning of this pretty big recession. And there were just no jobs for journalists. And so I decided that I would just try to make a living by doing freelance writing and doing computer consulting on the side. Now, what gave me the idea that I could... So I'm sorry, I forgot an important thing. So at MIT, I also started hanging out at the MIT Media Lab because MIT has this program called UROP, Undergraduate Research Opportunities Programs. And the Media Lab was the cool place to be. So I went over there and I got involved in optical storage, working with a bunch of people there, including Walter Bender and Andy Lipman. We made the second CD-ROM in the world, I think, and the first one in the United States, which was pretty cool. And we put digital video on it from a Major League Baseball World Series, and we got a technical report out, and that was a lot of fun. So I wrote a file system for Write Once Optical Storage. And because of that, I ended up getting a consulting gig at Polaroid, which was the film company across the street from MIT. They also made cameras, and they were experimenting with Write Once Optical Storage. They had a clever approach for making really cheap compact discs and really cheap Write Once compact discs. What they didn't understand when they started this out was that the reason compact discs at the time with music were $17 a piece in the stores, which was a lot of money. You know, it's like $50 in today's money or something, $40. And the people at Polaroid thought that the CDs were expensive because of the injection molding. They could make them for a tenth the price. But it turns out they were just expensive because that was what the market would bear. So being able to make CDs at a tenth the price really wasn't a big innovative thing. And being able to do, printing them on a web press instead of doing injection molding turned out not to be that important either. So the, when I graduated Columbia, I could easily, I had a gig at Polaroid doing software development, and there were other people asking for software development. And again, I didn't think that there was anything to computer science besides writing code, and I could write code. So that was kind of fun. And I was writing newspaper stories and magazine stories on the side. And I kept suffering from really, really bad advising. It's just a perennial thing. I wrote up a novel about my time as an undergraduate. And I sent it to an editor at Doubleday, and the editor at Doubleday said, I like this, but it's twice as long as it should be. Cut it in half and we'll consider publishing it. And I thought that was a rejection. So I put it aside, which is.
So, we do advisory services. So now that you're at the point where you've admitted you need advice, we're available, but we're expensive. So
yeah, it's a little right along.
So you're doing consulting.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. And so then eventually, you moved into more advanced subject matter. So how did you make the transition? Yeah. And then what happened?
So what happened was, my mother was a yoga person, and you can read her better on Wikipedia. Her name's Marion Garfinkel. And she had a friend from the yoga thing who was at a company called Cambridge Research Associates. And Cambridge Research Associates was a computer company. They did some time sharing software, but they shared office space with a company called O'Reilly and Associates, which was publishing books. And O'Reilly decided that they wanted to have a book on computer security. And I said, I know a little bit about security. At this point, I had written an article on computer security for a magazine called The Practical Lawyer, which is a legal journal. And I'd also written an article about them about email and why lawyers should be using email. I think the sequence was I wrote the email article and then like the lawyer said, well, there's lots of security problems with computers. And so I wrote about the security issues also, why it shouldn't scare them off from using computers for email. And so the folks at O'Reilly asked if I could work on a book on security. And I said, sure, that sounds like fun. And about 2 months into this book project, the Morris worm hits. So, and it really annoyed me at the time because I was doing like a computer consulting thing that day. And so I wasn't able to write the story about this big internet worm thing going on. A few months later, I was going to go to a conference that the American Association for the Advancement of Science, they did a special session on the internet worm. And so that was kind of fun. And around this time, I realized that I'm completely out of my depth on the security book and I better get help. And so one of the people who was going to be speaking at that conference was Gene Spafford. And I reached out to Gene and I asked him if he would be interested in co-authoring the book with me. And he was very excited to do that. That was the start of our collaboration together. And we actually put together a decent book on computer security, which ended up being published in like 91. So that was my, I ended up having to learn the security stuff so that I could write about it, which is what happens at most universities too. When people have to teach a course for the first time, they actually have to learn the material because it's much harder to teach the course or to write the book if you don't have like a really good level of understanding of the material.
Yeah, so you have to stay one week ahead of the class, right?
You can try. That I've done that once teaching a Java course, but a lot of that course I was teaching the students how to read the documentation and the importance of reading the documentation. So yeah.
Storytelling, if you just notice the way he talks, he's always telling a story. You will never get an answer without a story, right?
Well, I can appreciate that. It's all buried in stories, right? You know, the analogy is the academic path, you know, so, you know, Simpson went to, you know, the classic, you know, big universities, MIT and Columbia and so forth. You know, I went to Greenville Tech. I was landscaping my way during the day to take some classes at night, but it's the same as we talk so often, right? You know, the hacker doesn't really matter the context. It's, are you exploiting the opportunities around you? And, you know, with Simpson's path, you know, the articles working with Spaff, you know, and, you know, this is, I think it's, yeah, now I'd really love to sit with Simpson and compare notes on this one, right? Because I've been thinking most of my life, you know, that this traditional education model, getting a PhD from MIT, how classic can you get, doesn't necessarily mean, you know, you can't know the things. You know, you have to, you know, I was teaching at Greenville Tech in the first year, my first year in computers, and I got saddled suddenly with a 5-day, 40-hour class, you know, Monday to Friday on C, and I didn't know C. Every single night. I don't think I slept that week. I'm reading all night long, you know, coming up, you know, up to speed so I can teach the class the next day.
Chris, just so everybody knows, C is a programming language. And right. Yes, there was an A and a B before that.
Right. And yeah, so but it's not imposter syndrome, right? You know, lots of people out there with and without the PhDs were worried, you know, that they, you know, might get caught out with not knowing everything. It's a very common conversation these days. You know, it's not, you know, maybe, you know, 100 years ago, you could know all the classics. That's not the way the world works now. Now you need to know how much you can do yourself, when you pull in other expertise, and how you get things done.
It's interesting because this happenstance. So I think one of the advantages, again, of going to a place like MIT is that you're across the street from this and you're next door to that. And my mother is here and connects me with that, just like Bill Gates, right? So I think there are people that have these advantages. That's part one. But part two is taking advantage of those advantages.
Right. Is all those people at school with Simpson and at all those times, you know, he's the one we're talking about. So even with the advantages, and in the flip side, you know, I'm literally hacking my way across the landscape by hand, and we sort of ended up in the same place.
Right. So it's the, what is it, where opportunity meets happenstance?
Right. Yep.
Yeah. So the more I listen to the things that people are telling us, the more I hear all their stories, the more I see just how much that combination is. Luck favors the prepared mind. So if you are thinking in the right directions or able to recognize where you are and the world happens around you, then you can encounter things that are beneficial. And regardless of what path you happen to take, you're going to have a completely different path based on the combination of what you interact with and how you interact with it. Whereas that, you know, it seems like it's stupidly obvious. You know, the question is, how do you have the luck, right? You make your luck by being at the right place in the right time. How do you figure out the right place in the right time? Well, that's something that you actually can do.
Well, right? and as compassionate humans also, just as, you know, competent statisticians, we have to understand that there's two sides to this, you know, ellipse. You know, you can do all the right things and it may not work out. Right. You know, we have too much, you know, in my opinion, but too much of these days of those, you know, those people, those slackers. Like, you know, look, you know, you can make your own luck. You know, I think I did. I think Simpson did. I think you did. You know, however, right, you can also do all the right things. And statistically, that's not going to work out for some people sometimes their entire lives. You know,
so I think that that's sort of right. But I think, you know, you keep trying, right? It is a statistical sure. game. So I look at investing, right? So I do early stage investing. And the statistics say 70% of these companies are going to fail. Now, I don't have, you know, $1 billion sitting around, so I can just toss $1 million at each, you know, and do 1,000 of them and end up with, you know, 10 billion, you know, 10 years later or something. So, you know, that's not the way it works for me. But so you have to be more, you know, picky and choosy. But at the end of the day, if you stop trying, that's where you're going to fail.
Yes. Well, you know, again, as we do, we're sort of getting in the weeds here, but I think it's important to state, you know, that you know, you look at the opposite ends, you know, so Bill Gates, Simpson, perhaps, you know, who had these great opportunities and used them, good for them. And on the opposite end, you know, there are people who didn't have any opportunities and still worked out. However, if you had to choose one of those ends and your likelihood to succeed, you know, the same individual at either end, you know, started the good end. You know,
So I want to go back to the ethics and morals issue, because a lot of people are brought up in a way that says, don't succeed. That is, anything where you might conceive that you're taking advantage of a situation, it's unfair and you shouldn't do it. So there are different ethical and moral codes and trainings and teachings that I think cause people to fail or succeed. And it's sort of very interesting. I don't want to get into religion, but I just want to, you know, there's a framework here that says that there's a point of view about the world and what you should and shouldn't do that mixes with the time that you are in the world, right? Because the world changes with time, society changes with time. And being in sync with that is one of those things that makes you, I think, very much more successful or more likely to be successful.
Yeah, that's why I like, you know, this whole cyber profession, you know, this, you know, chess club, bunch of geeks, you know, working on everything, you know, because they're all systems of systems. And, you know, it's the... Yeah, I quote Terry Pratchett a lot, and I can do it again. Unseen academicals, there's a great analogy in there, the crab bucket. You know, the idea is you can put a bunch of crabs in a bucket and not put a top on it, and they'll all stay in it. Because if one tries to climb out, they all will. Or, you know, they'll drag them back in. And the analogy is to a lot of, you know, working class social structures where if you're seen, you know, to be getting above your station, right? And I think that does hold a lot of people back. We let these structures, you know, to my point about being a geek, you know, this is just another programming language. It's social programming language, right? You know, we need to understand the limitations of that and if that's holding you back. So,
right. So you talk about the glass ceiling, which holds people back, but there's some other set of ceilings, right? There's other ceilings that have to do with how you're brought up or your profession or your view of the world. And I think that's what's holding me back. So I'm going to stop being held back and we're going to go on to the next thing of the show.
We're talking to Doug, who has spent a lifetime dealing with the issues of identity management and has consulted for many of the largest enterprises in the world in this arena.
So, Doug, we were talking about what happens when you figure out the right way to build something that's narrowly focused.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yes.
And instead of the general purpose database, you create, you know, these LDAP directories, Lightweight Directory Access Protocol, mm-hmm. focused on very specific things in a well-defined, commonly shared schema mm-hmm. that turned, because of the World Wide Web, into an explosive growth industry that had a just incredible effect on the world. So just tell us, you were there at the beginning. Tell us what happened.
Well, I think it was the explosion of e-commerce. That was the big big word, if you will, at that point in time, because as soon as you could start to create, remember, it was called brick and mortar, right? It was goodbye brick and mortar. Online commerce sites, you needed to be able to authenticate a customer, and you needed to be able to...
Hang on. They had what was called EDI, right? Electronic mm-hmm. Data Interchange.
I worked in that too, X.409 or something like that, whatever.
Well, but EDI was the methodology for moving money around, right? So I would buy a good or a service, I can do that. But EDI just didn't survive this, right?
It wasn't for the end users. It wasn't for me to go to a website and buy something, you know? It was
just for business-to-business transactions, right?
Yes, usually large sums of money. Yes, it was funds transactions. So
this all changed mm-hmm. because of this, a couple of fundamental problems, right?
Yep.
So I can think of at least two really fundamental problems that this had an effect on. One of them is systems administration.
Mm-hmm.
So it used to be, before this era, that systems administration consisted of one person that administered perhaps 20 or 30 systems.
Yes.
Controlling every detail of every protection setting, every user authorized in every system, all the files, everything they had access to, all the backups and everything. One person was the systems. And you could only do so many.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't supported. All right. So that's part one. And part two is cost. So when you're going to go scale that, if you have a million systems, you now, you know, if it's 100 each, you now have 10,000 systems Absolutely. Administrators.
That's right.
And so the cost per system is 1/100 of a full-time employee. Mm-hmm. And if you're going to go to a billion systems, that's going to be bloody expensive.
Absolutely correct.
So how did this change that?
I would say fundamentally, there are a couple things. Number one, I didn't mention this, or maybe I did in passing, but the group object was probably one of the most important elements in the early days of the directory services we're talking about here, because you could put identities, which is essentially a string, a unique identifier for every person in the organization, into a group. And then you could do access controls to data or applications based on group membership rather than hard coding that user identity into the application itself. So you quickly had this intermediary service that you could look up to see if the appropriate group membership or other attribute values associated with this person would allow them to access something. So again, that became, I think, a huge step forward.
So now just for clarity, groups were on the path to roles and rules, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
All right. So we'll talk about roles and rules in a little bit. But so groups, so now instead of going and administering each system and saying, here's a user and you have a user ID in this system. And the other problem is that with a lot of users, of course, the user identities became horribly impossible.
And people leave organizations and sometimes not always on the best of terms, and you got to clean them out.
Of hundreds and hundreds of systems.
Mm-hmm.
And they changed jobs.
Absolutely correct.
All right. So, but the transformation went from you control every identity on every system into I have these intermediate systems, you call them. I'll call them risk aggregation points.
Yeah.
Right? Well, you're aggregating all those decisions into one computer or a small number of computers so that every computer in the network has to go check the infrastructure.
Well, I didn't mention replication yet, but yes, go on.
Oh, replication. We'll get there. All right. Yeah. So now what's happening is instead of just checking on the local system, you have to check the network. So if the network's not working, you can't do anything, right?
Oh, yes. That is correct. Yes.
All right. Yep. Dead without the network, mm-hmm. creating interdependencies and supply chain issues. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
But efficiency scale. In exchange for resiliency, right?
Absolutely.
The efficiency is now I have somebody in HR that says, here's a new person in a job.
Mm-hmm.
And because they have that job, their boss can be identified as the mm-hmm. group of bosses for people mm-hmm. in that organization. And you can send an email out and they can say, oh, these are the things that person's allowed to do. And then you put them in those groups.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. The difference here is something like a factor of 1,000 or more in reduction of work.
Absolutely for correct.
Administration. However, there's another thing that comes along with this, and that is when you change it in that server, you now have to do deployment of changes throughout the network.
Right, right.
So when I'm now given a phone number, remember when you used to get a phone number, like for a cell phone, it took like an hour and a half sitting there at the dealer, and they'd have to punch in 500 numbers to the phone. They have to call up, and somebody in a central server would have to add you and all this deployment stuff. Right. That got changed at that same time. And so that rollout of information to all the systems, what was that called? Provisioning. That's it.
Provisioning. Oh, man.
To the theme of nothing ever changes, you know, within the last 2 hours, a fascinating conversation. I don't know if I'll typify it, but it was a journalist and one of the former chief scientists of one of the big three certificate authorities about identity and where we are right now in federated identity. And so much of what Doug was talking about and you were talking about is kind of the part of the roots of that or the same tree. And it's interesting. The point is similar to what we were just discussing. It works, right? You know, is it done yet? Can you actually, but no, you know, it's revolving systems, right? You know, the identity issue, right? If you walk into a bank and you show us some paper ID, that's worked. Now, can you fake that? Yes, but it works well enough.
Right, well enough being sort of the critical point, but increasingly we're now getting into identity management of things, right? So we have IoT devices, which is, you know, now more devices than people, I guess, a long way and growing. So the number of things that have to be identified and then authorized for different functions is becoming vast. The other huge change that we've seen is because, you know, this was 25 plus years ago we're talking about, same problem, but now the notion of going without the network is almost, you know, incomprehensible, right? So nobody does anything without the network anymore.
So right. And you can't help saying, you know, so many, you know, de facto pieces of wisdom have fallen by the wayside, right? You know, the air gap in critical infrastructure and, you know, now everybody, you know, who knows what they're talking about is now talking about cloud OT, which to be clear, that means that there's software running on some computer in a data center somewhere is controlling the behavior of your physical valve, your device. That's where we're going, right? That's fine, as long as you accept it and engineer towards that as opposed to, anyways.
Well, so for certain levels of assurance, that's right.
For certain levels, that's right.
But you know, the other side of it is, you know, at the end of the day, anything that's mobile, you're going to have to communicate with it some way other than physically being present. Right. So any military equipment, any, you know, drones, you know, any kind of a missile system, any kind of an aerial system, any kind of an underwater system, you know, if you're going to communicate and have feedback so you can actually control it in flight, you know, that's it. You need a network. And so now, of course, this increases the challenges associated with electromagnetic pulse attacks. And a wide variety of other, you know, interception and exploitation and disruption attacks. And so, you know, the game changes and this battle between two sides is never ending, right? The more technology advances, the more critical that is, the more vulnerabilities there are because of the increased complexity of systems, the more problems there are. But the other side of it is we have all these enormous benefits.
Right. Well, you know, the sun is balancing gravity and the explosive power of nuclear fission, you know, at the same time. And, you know, the oxygen is this horribly, you know, reactive element. But, you know, it drives all human life, right? Causes a lot of problems, but, right, you know, so this whole network effect, it gets back to the principles of the internet, right, of networks at all, of human networks and social networks. You know, is the advantage greater than the disadvantage? The answer is yes, obviously. Look around us.
Well, so whether it's better or not, I mean, for the long-term survival of humanity, as in when the Earth falls into the sun, we definitely have to be off planet. And that also means, obviously, we need to travel in space, which means we need to work together. So being interdependent and working together collaboratively means, this whole idea, you know, we've talked about this before, right? This whole idea that somehow the elites will go to an island and live great by themselves and everybody else will fall over. You know, this is nuts, right?
Good fiction, yeah.
Somebody has to pick up the garbage And even if you have a robot to do that, somebody has to fix the robot. And even if you have a robot to do that, you know, eventually, you know, people are going to be
all the way down. Yes. Elephants all the way down with people. Yes.
That's right.
Next week on the Cyber Show, another great pitch for another great company or not. Peter gets bugged by the bugs. Simpson tells us about his technique. Doug starts provisioning. More fraud, spies, and lies, and much more. Don't miss it next week on the Cyber Show.
A good time and bow. A good time and bow. A string beating man and a fiddler for a band. A good time and bow.
The Cyber Show was brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.